very important pain point is how do we retain them?
My view on retention is really straightforward, to be honest with you. It's about providing impeccable customer service. That covers a lot of things, but providing impeccable customer experience. From the moment that they touch your brand to signing up to doing the KYC piece and getting through onto your platform, the emails that you then follow up with and send should be valuable, purposeful, helpful. The content that you're then putting out on your socials is not just for attracting new customers, but for keeping your existing customers engaged. And again, they should be valuable, purposeful, helpful. And then every contact with your customer service team. The customer service team is now the customer retention team, because in a market where you've got limited budget and customers are hard to find, you've got to make sure that you're getting the most from your existing customers and pushing up lifetime value.
Hello and welcome back to Purpose Driven FinTech. I am your host, Moni Millares. In today's episode, we put Growth Gorilla to the test. We have Shamir Sachdev, founder and MP at Growth Gorilla, and he shares with us his hypothesis on why he thought his business could win by adding value no one was giving at a time. He expands on the power of diversity and why it is the key to unlocking building purposeful fintechs. He shares how Growth Gorilla is having impact in millions of customers despite not having the financial services offerings, and the one thing we can do as fintechers to have 10 times the results in solving for the problem of financial stress. After discussing all things impact and purpose, we do a deep dive on how we can grow fintechs during times of turbulence and budget cuts. He shares with us the current key trends and challenges that fintechs are facing when it comes to scaling and growth, how to create a bulletproof retention strategy, how influencer marketing and the so-called finfluencers are here to supercharge your fintech impact driven by customer demand on financial educational content, and much, much more. If you enjoyed this pod, please give it a like, reach out, share, and let's go for it. Hello, Shamir. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Monica. I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation because it is very relevant given where we are in the fintech space and the macroeconomic climate. We all as fintechers, we have a lot of pressure to deliver, especially when it comes to growth, marketing numbers, acquisition. However, our budget, our traditional marketing budget to go and do all these amazing initiatives has been reduced. So we need to be more creative. We need to be more resourceful, have impact and still drive those numbers, but without the resources or with less resources. So this is a brilliant conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. So first things first, this is a podcast about how we can build more purpose-driven fintechs. So what's your take? How do we build more purpose-driven?
I thought about this question a lot, and I think it boils down to two areas, really. For me, the most important thing really is the diversity piece. I think we need a more diverse range of founders. It's no secret that VCs are heavily invested in and behind founders who are predominantly male, predominantly white, predominantly middle class. It's not a secret. I think we're all aware of it now, and I think we can openly discuss it. But I think if we're going to create more purposeful fintechs, we need to have a more diverse range of founders, because those founders coming from different backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different ethnic groups, different genders, etc., they're going to be able to surface pain points, challenges, problems that the current fintech archetype has not ever encountered or come across. Another way to put it is that they're going to ask the questions that aren't being asked at the moment. And I think the other thing as well is that we can probably add on to that and just tack on to that and say it's not going to be solved by traditional sort of market research. because if you don't know what questions to ask, you're not going to get the answers that need to be given. So yeah, for me, I think if we want to start there and we want the answers, in summary, it's we need more diversity from the outset.
Yeah, I like that. And I'm going to build on that. I like that you used the definition of diversity very broadly. It was not like women in fintech. It was like all sorts of founders with all sorts of backgrounds. And exactly like you say, it's not that there's something wrong with the current cohort. It's more if we open the set of founders to come from different backgrounds, then the lens in which they view the world is different. Hence, they start asking different questions. They start seeing problems where the others, given that they are the same cut, the others may have not seen them. So that's why diversity could bring a different angle. And then given that it brings a different angle, then it opens up tons of opportunities, actually.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think I think there's also, there's other elements to it as well. We've seen some of the most successful companies being founded by women. Look at Starling Bank in the UK. We talk about female CEOs. I think the former CEO, I can't remember her name now, Indian ethnically, but then obviously female as well. And then a lot of the diverse perspective, and ethnically speaking, a lot of the tech firms now out in the States have Indian CEOs that are leading them. Satya Nadella at Microsoft, and so many others as well. So I think the proof has been provided now, and I think VCs just need to have a bit more of an open mind.
Definitely. So let's move on to you as such. So you have this term, helping fintechs grow without limits. What does that mean? Can you tell us a little bit about Growth Gorilla and your purpose?
Yeah, of course. If I start a bit, you're talking about Growth Gorilla first and what we do, and then we get on to helping fintechs grow without limits. We're a growth marketing agency. We've been around for about 7 years now. We focus predominantly and almost up until recently entirely on the fintech sector. We've opened that up now to financial services, or perhaps better to say tech-enabled financial services. The lines are getting blurred day by day. And that just started off off the back of my background. I was in financial services. I was marketing director. I had a trading platform for a while, for about 5 years. And then I decided that I particularly enjoyed marketing, and then decided to do some consulting, which eventually led into the development of the agency. I think from a purpose perspective, the reason I always focused on fintech to begin with is partly down to my background, which was, it was an online trading platform. It was an area that I was very familiar with naturally. But what made it interesting was that the fintech space over the last 7 years is a hotbed of disruption. And there's lots of interesting things happening. It's disrupting everything from basic technology, onboarding KYC, but then also at the same time, it's creating opportunity for a whole array of individuals. And I've got some examples of some of the clients that we've worked with that I think are particularly good examples of that. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And then, yeah, helping fintechs to grow without limits. I think that's our way of saying to our customers, our clients, our prospects that we can support them with their growth and not to have a cap on what's achievable.
Mm-hmm. And then just to build on that, because exactly, that's a very nice mindset. It will help you grow beyond what you think is achievable. What was your hypothesis when you started the business? Because there's so many agencies, right? There's so many businesses, whichever it is. So what made you think, I'm going to be different, going to help customers in a different way. Therefore, I'm betting on myself that we'll be able to help them grow.
Yeah. So look, the hypothesis at the time was pretty simple. I'd left the trading platform and fintech was not quite a word just yet. It was 7 years ago. It was still bubbling around in the background. But from my perspective, it was more around just helping app-based or tech-based financial services companies that had a really simple formula. Marketing website, online sign-up journey, and then some sort of app, either way it's a back-end dashboard on the web or a mobile app. Yeah. That was it, really, because that wasn't particularly popular at that time, that setup. Now you see it everywhere. You see it everywhere from Free Trade to Starling Bank to every fintech basically has those three ingredients. But, you know, let's bear in mind that when I started working at the brokerage, it was a PR event that we launched our app. We were still manually checking KYC. There wasn't on Fido. Wow. Hadn't been embedded at all. The applicants were coming in. We were putting them through World Check or whatever. And then we were then going out to them and asking for their documents and stuff. So it's a really manual process. I'm older than I look. I hail from back in the days when we were opening client accounts by calling them up and actually receiving paper forms filled out. And then they would have to actually post their passports and a utility bill and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, the hypothesis was just really simple that to support those organizations that had that set up. And I knew firsthand that there weren't a lot of agencies that were set up for that because, you know, having been on the client side, we had a lot of agencies coming that we invited in, had approached us to pitch, to talk about how they could help us. And we kept running into challenges and problems because they hadn't quite grasped the concept of trading, first and foremost. And then second of all, at that time, you know, SEO and PPC and that sort of stuff was a lot more focused around e-commerce and FMCG and stuff like that. And social media was basically non-existent at that point. None of our competitors were running campaigns on Instagram and TikTok. Wow. It wasn't even a word that had been even thought of just yet. And so, yeah, I knew there was a bit of a problem there, a bit of an issue there. So, decided to just start reaching out to fintech brands and having a conversation and saying, look, this is my background. I think I can help you. And yeah, it turns out I could.
Yeah, good for you. And it seems like the environment has changed a lot since then, right? Now that you said, yeah, we used to do KYC with paper as such.
Yeah.
Whoa, that is such a long time ago. But then even though technology has changed at a super rapid pace, it seems like the problem statement that we are trying to solve, that it's like helping people have less stress with money and better financial well-being, it seems like that hasn't changed, as in improved, so much since then. On the contrary, like just in the UK, the average person today in 2024, they only have £11,000 in savings, while 16% of people have no savings at all. That's like bad. And 25% of people only have £200 for this. So technology has grown, fintechs have grown, but the problem statement has grown as well. We haven't solved it that well. So this is a very important question. How are you as Growth Gorilla actually having impact on customers' financial lives?
Yeah, I think... It's somewhat of a difficult question to answer because to a certain degree we're at the behest of the industry, right? So if the entire industry is, you know, having an impact, then naturally we will have an impact by helping them communicate their message. But I think, you know, the direct impact that we had, and I was thinking about this, you know, prior to recording, we worked with, you know, I think it's about 40 different fintech brands today. It might be a little bit more than that now. And the one that always comes to mind is we were working with it's a company called Way Home. They've got great investors, Anthemis and Augmentum Fintech. And, you know, the product's about disrupting traditional home ownership. So they call it gradual home ownership. I think the nearest thing akin to it would be something like Help to Buy, but it's actually a little bit better than that. And that's a really unusual proposition. No one's really been successful at disrupting the mortgage market. And you know, the direct impact was we've supported them with getting over 250 families into homes that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to purchase via the traditional infrastructure. When we look at direct impact, you know, that's what you see was really cool when we got the first one, the first sort of family in, and we were like, oh, okay. It's a really long process buying a property, right? It's not short. And then suddenly 10 to 25, then 50, and yeah, now they're well over a couple of hundred. But also things like, for example, we worked with an Indonesian-based trading app. They're very similar to like Free Trade or Robinhood, but based out in Indonesia. And you know, out there, the problem's slightly different. You've got either the choice, as an investor, you've got the choice of either Indonesian stock market, which is a bit choppy at best, and mutual funds, which are, the management fees are ridiculous. We're talking sort of 5% plus. It's crazy. Here was this app, GoTrade, that allowed Indonesian investors to access global markets for free, basically. That monetized on the back of FX fees, etc. and stuff. There, it's thousands upon thousands of users. And there's, as I said, we work with 40 different, you know, brands. So there's so many more examples. But, you know, all of those things, I think I did sit down at one point and worked out how many signups or accounts we've opened across all of our accounts. It's well into the millions. And I think just to know that we've impacted millions of people, being the conduit and supporting our clients, yeah, you know, it's pretty cool, actually.
It is. And I was really genuinely looking forward to what you were about to say, because many times we think, oh, I'm a fintech, I'm a B2C fintech, right? So it's like the impact is very clear because I have a product with the customer directly. But for everyone who's behind that fintech, supporting that fintech do their jobs, basically, it's sometimes a little bit not that direct, a little bit ambiguous, yeah. A bit behind the scenes. But it's super cool to be like, yeah, even if we are anyone that is part of the ecosystem is still having impact in people's lives. Therefore, all of us need to think of ourselves as people who are having impact in the main problem.
Yeah, and then you've got an active choice as well, right? I don't think we don't necessarily turn around and say we're only going to work with impact, work with fintechs who are going to have a material impact. But equally, at the same time, we do say we're not going to work with brands or organizations who, frankly speaking, are having a negative impact. Or we think that they, especially at the time when crypto was really bubbling away, and that was a crazy period, and we were getting contacted, you know, every other day by the latest platform or the latest, can I say shitcoin, is that all right?
Yeah.
That, or they wanted to do an ICO or whatever it is, and we just steered away from them because it was just, it's not something that I want to be involved with. And I think there is an ethical piece behind that. But I think by and large, yeah, if you're working with brands and companies and products that you believe in, then and support them, then yeah, you can have a material impact.
One of the questions that I referred to at the beginning of the conversation was, we fintechs as an industry, we've been around for 8, 10, 12 years, roughly. There's a ton of money that has been invested in the industry. We have proof of concept. It's been 10 years. We have some very successful fintechs as such. But like I said, yes, we have had impact in customers. Yes, we have. But people still have a ton of stress when it comes to money. The rising cost of living, the layoffs, retirement planning, there are still many pain points. So if we continue to have the impact that we have today, that rate, by the time we retire, I think we could have had an impact, but not massive. So what do you think we need to change in our mindset so that we're like, hey, in the 5 to 10 years time, we have radical impact and we change genuinely, not marginal impact, but genuinely change the lives of many people because they are financially sound?
I think we want to have radical impact. Then, I mean, the only way that's really going to happen is at a grassroots level. What I mean by that is that I think it's all well and good trying to educate your late 20s, early 30-year-old and having a nice friendly tone of voice about financial products and stuff like that. And that's helpful, but that's not going to have a material impact because by that time people's habits have formed, their opinions have formed, and if they've got just a natural aversion to money-related stuff, then you're not going to be able to influence them that much. So you need to go younger. And I think we need to go all the way down to primary school, elementary school, and teaching financial education and making people financially literate needs to happen at school, and they need to understand the impacts of the decisions that they are making with their money now and how that will impact them in the future. They need to understand how taxes work. They need to understand that they need to save, and they need to understand how investing works. They need to understand risk. I think on online on social media platforms, I've never used Pythagoras' theorem, but it would have been helpful to work out how tax works. And I do think that's a genuine issue. Not knowing the difference between a fixed rate and a variable mortgage is just, it's not acceptable, and it's not the individual's fault. It's frankly, in my view, I think it's the government that has then let people down. So I think, yeah, that needs to happen at grassroots level. And I think it's, as fintechers, what can we do? I think there's probably two things we can do. I think the larger organizations need to lead by example, and they need to get in there and build these programs with schools directly and help educate young people around money. And if you want some incentive, there's a very good reason why HSBC, Barclays, NatWest have child accounts. It's because that they know that the lifetime value, once someone signs up, they're going to just, it's for decades. So Monzo, Starling, there's some incentive for you there. The other thing that they need to be doing is working directly with the government and having those conversations with them and lobbying them and putting pressure on them in order to make it a priority in schools. And I think until that happens, then we're not going to see that impact. But then the problem is then we have to always then work out, in these sorts of things, whose interest is it in for people to not be financially educated? And then that's usually the person who's, or the individuals or the body that needs to be highlighted and tasked with doing that. And then, yeah, I think, again, it goes back to also that piece around diversity and inclusion as well. If we invest in more diverse founders, a more diverse range of founders, we're going to surface those problems that we don't know exist. And therefore, then we're going to have products, features, and all the stuff that goes with that to help support the I would say not the individuals, but perhaps communities that have a tendency to suffer from lack of financial education. And that, yeah, that'd be my view in terms of, yeah, if you want to have a 10 times impact, that needs to happen.
I love that, because especially like now towards the end, you're focusing on the communities as such. So it's not, okay, how can we help people save more or with financial education only? But it's more of a, hey, what's the impact to the wider community? And then let's identify those communities. Maybe we start with that, right? Rather than, oh, we need to educate all the children. We start with pilot. Like, you could. Let's see. Awesome. I want to change the conversation a little bit, because of course, if we want to have a ton of impact, we need to reach to these people. We need to put our products and education programs and whatever we're doing in front of people. And just like we said at the beginning of the conversation, resources are very tight at the moment. We do have diversity within the fintechs that we have, right? So we have the unicorns and super hyper growth fintechs, people in between, and the ones that are just getting started. So it's different maturity. What do you think are the current trends and challenges that all these fintech companies are having, specifically when it comes to scaling and growth?
Yeah, so I think in the current market, like you mentioned, obviously budget is a big one. All right, that's the biggest challenge, right? Yeah, there's a lack of budget, and that's going to be the main issue. I think the other challenge is as well is that the landscape has changed as well, in the sense that it's no longer growth at all costs, and it's now about profitability. That's what business should have been about from day one, in my view. But there's a lot of unlearning that needs to be done. And I think we're now towards probably this end point with this kind of shock or this change in landscape. We've reached the point where money started to dry up. Interest rates started to rise, cost of living, all of that sort of stuff started to happen. And the fintechs, the founders of those fintechs that made those decisions to start cutting costs, focus on profitability, look, they're still here. Those that didn't, they're not getting funded, but the ones that are still here, they are going to get funded. So there's something I'm learning to do there. I think the other challenges are going to be as well is that previously, a lot of the traditional financial services companies tried to enter the fintech market and done a bad job of it. There's some real clangers there, not to name any names. But now, they've had time. They've spent money. They've seen what's worked, what hasn't worked. And they're in a pretty favorable position. They've got very deep pockets. They've got ailing companies that they can acquire to enter a space. And there's talent out there that's been let go that they can bring on board. So I think one of the biggest challenges is going to be for a lot of fintechs is fighting off the incumbents as they enter the space with new propositions. Good example is Zing. I know Wise has been doing their PR and they've been doing a great job of it. But I'm not being funny. HSBC has incredibly deep pockets. They've got a lot of staying power.
Definitely. Just today, I wrote a piece in the newsletter just about that, that it's like, oh, Hong Kong, but this is not our traditional fintechs as such, but it's more focusing on the blockchain and this and the other, right?
Yeah. So
it's Hong Kong, but what a bank in Hong Kong is doing, like first, world first, doing this, the other. And then as I was analyzing that piece, I was like, so what's the biggest takeaway here? The biggest takeaway here is now the banks are becoming the disruptors because they have a ton of money. The fintechs were trying to survive. Like the roles are reversing.
Yeah, there's a good saying that I like, which is when the center collapses, the periphery becomes the center. And we're on our way there. But these things go full circle, right? It's banks will start to lead the way. They'll become the disruptors. And then on the back of that, people will break away and we'll have new companies and it'll start all over again. So, yes, I think those are the biggest challenges for the moment.
Cool. And then, so those are big challenges, right? So I'll focus more on the answer, like the strategy as such. How do we solve those challenges? What's your recipe for growth?
Yeah, look, I think, so as we're picking off some of those challenges, I think, look, if you've got a budget issue, then I think I've got sort of two responses to that. So I think one is that come to terms with it very quickly. It's going to be like that for a little while. Accept it, make your peace, and align yourself with your CFO is now your best friend as a CMO. And I think you've got to do two things there. So my two sort of responses. One is any activity that you're doing, any marketing activity that you're doing, I think you've really got to ask yourself, is this going to drive results, tangible results, or are we just doing it for the sake of doing it? What is the thinking behind it? Because we all get into to autopilot sometimes, but it's worthwhile just breaking down all of the channels you're focused on and all the activity you're focused on and really interrogating it, sitting there going, what value is this driving? Why we do it? So if we did half as much, would it have the same impact? And then just really going through your strategy piece, all your channels that way. And then I think then from that, also thinking about creative and being creative. And then going back to talking about, speaking about just doing things for the sake of it. Is that ad that you're putting out there, is it going to have cut through? Is that content piece that you're pushing out there, is it really going to turn heads? And the answer is, if it's not, then just don't do it. You're just wasting time, energy, and budget. You're better off doing one piece of activity that's amazing and gets eyeballs on your brand than trying to do five or six things. The game is not volume anymore. The game is not quantity anymore. The game's quality now. And then the second thing I said about becoming the CFO's best friend. I was talking to a CMO on Monday, and I said that one of my clients has cut a deal with their CFO, and he started laughing. And he said, cut a deal. And I was like, yes. We carried on talking as he goes, I too have cut a deal with my CFO. It's a common thing that the senior CMOs are doing. They will come into the CFO and they're saying, look, if we've got this move to profitability, if I deliver X and we show Y amount of profit, can we take some of that and reinvest? Okay, because you need to have your CFO on side, because he's sitting there or she's sitting there and thinking, marketing is an expense. I don't want to spend it. We have these fixed costs. You need to demonstrate to your CFO that you are a profit center, not a cost to the business. And I think if you start doing that, the cool thing about that is that you'll become a lot more focused on your numbers as well. We'll cut off all our necessary stuff. And then when you start showing profits, you then have that cash back to then start doing the more interesting, sexy stuff that you wanted to do in the first place.
Yeah, I like that as an approach because it reminds me of sales, right? I don't work in sales as such, but it's more like
as a salesperson, you're driven by having results because basically your income depends on those results. So now we're saying, hey, us as fintechers in the product marketing departments and such growth departments, we say, okay, no money. Don't worry. I have enough to go and do my work, show results. And then basically, if I have the results, as part of the payoff of that is I get some budget to then go on the board. So it's a conversation from no resource to being resourceful to then start getting traction.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I had a similar deal with my CEO when I was client side. And that deal stayed in place for the 5 years I was there. And we turned a 300 grand a year budget, not a lot, 300 grand a year, into a couple of million. And my department showed profit year on year because of that. So I think it aligns the marketing team with the rest of the company then as well.
Yeah, I like that. Because at the end of the day, we need to be aligned, especially now. Like, there's no more silos. It needs to be as a company. So building on that, we finally got budget from the CFO. We made a deal with him or her. And we started acquiring customers. So one of the challenges is, one, are we acquiring the right type of customers? Because that is just a simple, very important pain point. That is, how do we retain them?
Okay, so how do we retain them? My view on retention is, I think it's really straightforward, to be honest with you. I think it's about providing impeccable customer service. I think if you're listening, that covers a lot of things. Or maybe customer experience is a better way of terminology, but providing impeccable customer experience. From the moment that they touch your brand to signing up to doing the KYC piece and getting through onto your platform or whatever, the emails that you then follow up with and send should be valuable, should be purposeful, should be helpful. The content that you're then putting out on your socials is not just for attracting new customers, but for keeping your existing customers engaged. And again, they should be valuable, they should be purposeful, they should be helpful. And then every contact with your customer service team. The customer service team is now the customer retention team, because in a market where you've got limited budget and customers are hard to find, you've got to make sure that you're getting the most from your existing customers and pushing up lifetime value. So to me, that's just all about customer experience. And then I think it's just the usual things of making sure that you're listening to your customers' feedback and then obviously product improvements, etc. And I think you can then add to that. I think once you've got that baseline in place and you've got that nailed, I think it's then about building out communities with your existing customers, and that creates brand affinity and brand loyalty and kind of all of those good things as well. But you can't go out there and start building communities and with your customer base if you're providing a rubbish customer experience, because you're just going to create a stick to be beaten with at that point. Yeah.
You used many big words in there that I want to unpack a little. One was experience, but I think we've covered customer experience as such. But then the other one is brand loyalty, because at the end of the day, there's many fintechs, right? Customers have a lot of choice at the moment, and many of them are really good. So if both of them are really good, why choose A over B? So part of that in my mind is there is this brand affinity, brand loyalty plays a big difference. I may be wrong, but I think it is important.
No, I think it does massively, right? I think in the UK, there's some really good examples of brand loyalty in the UK. One example is British Airways. They have a diehard customer base. And why is that? because British Airways align themselves with the British public by calling themselves British Airways. And Virgin tried to disrupt them and disrupt that position. Yeah, for a while. They haven't taken off their top spot for that. And I think that's kept them in the market and kept them alive so far to date. I think that brand loyalty piece is massive for, I think, scale-ups to establish fintechs, financial services companies. And I think that kind of goes, it circles all the way back to being purpose-driven, being impactful, and resonating with your target customers. I think that the audiences now that we're trying to acquire, so your millennials, your Gen Xs and your Gen Zs, they're very different from the boomer generation.
Yeah.
They're very much focused on a brand's purpose and a brand's impact, and does it align with their beliefs and all of that sort of stuff. And there's an opportunity there to open up an entire market if you can align your brand with your target customers' beliefs, not just their needs and wants.
That opens up a whole new conversation because they're
I'm not a brand marketer, by the way, but I do have a few views.
Yes, but that's cool because then now we're saying, I think it links really well. So that now we're saying, hey, millennials, Gen Zs, they are looking, and they are having like these introspective view of life as well. And then they are applying that to everything, not everything, but some of the things they consume. So also because of that, we've also seen the rise of influencer marketing. And what I find fascinating, fintech specifically, I don't know, like this week, I've seen this like at least twice on LinkedIn. Formula One, the future of fintech. I'm like, what? And now we are merging Formula One and all these famous people into fintech, which is very interesting. It's not related to purpose, but it's related to something that the audience relates to.
So look, influencer marketing is, it's a really interesting space at the moment. So I think first thing to say is that fintech financial services are so far behind on influencer marketing. They're almost not even off the start line just yet. Consumer goods, fashion, been doing it for years. It's almost not a, it's almost not even a point of discussion, but it is in fintech and financial services. And why is that? And it's for a couple of reasons. I think one is down to regulation, because fintechs, financial services companies have regulatory hoops to jump through. There are a lot of very concerned compliance people on how to manage and adopt influencer marketing. But they're definitely warming up to it. We've been offering sort of influencer activity for over a year now, and the climate has definitely changed within that year. It's gone from, we're absolutely not even going to consider this and I'm not going to get it past my compliance person, to, yes, we can do it, but we need to take these things into consideration. And I think the second reason why it's such a thing in the financial services fintech space is finfluencers. You don't really get that in other sectors. And finfluencers are individuals who are talking about offering financial information, not quite financial advice, but financial education and financial information, and educating or trying to educate other users on social media about whatever it may be, whether it's pensions or properties or whatever it is. And I think the reason for that is, and why we have that in the financial services space and the fintech space, is that it's quite simply, there's just a vacuum. And whenever there's a vacuum, it will be filled. And it'll be filled by people who have some knowledge. Now, how much knowledge that is varies, because there's obviously a quality aspect here. And then that goes circles back to what we talked about, there being the lack of financial education in schools or whatever it is and stuff. So that's probably the two sort of core reasons why it's now starting to become very noticeable. These influencer piece, the compliance people are now getting warmed up to the idea. And I think what's interesting, why it's particularly interesting in the fintech space, is acquiring customers is very expensive.
Yeah.
And in our early days, when we used to work with a lot more sort of startup brands, we tend to work with more sort of scale-ups and larger organizations now. But I think there was a huge amount of, let's call it optimism, as to what founders, marketers thought they were going to bring in users for. And I've lost business by saying the truth many a time, just because it's just unreasonable. They're never going to bring customers for a tenner a user. It's not going to happen. It is very expensive. And the reason for that is that financial services is big business. You've got incumbent brands that are indirect competitors for you. And so therefore, you're having to compete with the cost of media at their level, not at your level, at their level. So they're doing all of the out-of-home stuff. They're doing all the TV stuff, social media, Google search, etc. So influencers present a really good opportunity for fintechs, because the larger organizations, and I can name names here, but think of all of the large banks that you bank with, all of the ETF providers, they cannot get influencer off the ground. They're struggling to. And they're only able to do it at really small levels if they are able to do it. It just doesn't get past the compliance team. I'll tell you offline some of the names that I've got. It's a whole list. Your slightly smaller financial services companies are more able to do it, but this has been entrenched in the ways that they're doing it before. But for fintechs, it presents a great opportunity, because it's a great way to get in front of audiences that's not crowded with incumbents. And I think when you're a challenger and you partner with one or a handful of creators, influencers, subject matter experts, whatever you want to call them, and you develop a long-term relationship with them, you then end up creating an affinity with their audience as well. And that's the bit that makes it so attractive.
That is so interesting, because like you say, filling the gap that we discussed at the beginning, and they are having impact, because I don't remember the research, but lately you've seen this trend of customers are asking for financial education. And now there's the trend on Instagram and TikTok that it's cool to say, it has a specific name that I forgot, but it's basically cool to say, no, I don't have enough funds to go to the party. It's like open budgeting or something.
It was open budgeting. That's the latest one. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's always something that comes up. Was it Quiet Quitting a while back? And then it was Rage Quitting. And then, now it's Open Budgeting or something like that. Yeah. There's always something like some sort of trend. Yeah. But that's in the younger audience is a lot more open about talking about money, and social media has cultivated that. I don't think that's a bad thing at all whatsoever. I think it's a good thing. I think the only negative about it all is that there's always going to be some bad actors in space. But if I'm honest with you, every fintech brand that we've worked with, spoken to about any form of influencer marketing, at the top of their list, it's about integrity, and that they only want to be aligned with high quality creators. And actually, if there are any sort of creators listening to this, you're hugely incentivized to go down the right path, because that will be rewarded several fold, because brands do want to work with really, really credible individuals.
Yeah, that's right. Cool. So as we are approaching towards the end of the episode, what is the predominant strategic question that you have in your mind that keeps coming back in the top of your mind, that you're trying to solve that thing?
Yeah, look, we're an agency. So for me, our business is solving problems for clients. And so therefore, the strategic question behind that is, what are the problems that clients can't solve for themselves? And then how can we solve it for them? That's the only thing I see. If right now, I'm spotting a couple of trends at the moment. I think influencer is one, definitely. And then the second thing is, really interestingly, depends, it's interesting to me, but I think the multitude of social media platforms is now putting marketing teams under pressure in terms of having to create creative for every single platform. I've been looking at that, and we've been approached about 4 or 5 times in the last 6 weeks or so, 8 weeks or so. And so we're building out a product to help support that. So I'll be launching that in the next sort of few weeks. So we're in Feb now, so it'll come out in March. So yeah, so that's the strategic question that I'm asking myself.
Awesome. And that's very important, because it comes back to what we were saying. We don't have budgets, and with big budgets also means we don't have ton of people to then repurpose all this content across different platforms, because each platform has its own specificities. Not just like changing the format.
No.
There's so much more behind them. Yeah, that's a good one. As we approach towards the end, this is one of my favorite questions that I ask every single guest. So if we were to think one thing, we've talked about many things now, but if we were to think one thing in fintech that would have the most impact to customers, staff, and shareholders, what could that be?
I said it several times. It's that diversity piece again. I think if we want to have, the most positive impact, I think investors really need to broaden who they're investing in. And then think about what they're investing in. I think that would be brilliant. If we had more time, we could probably rattle through a whole bunch of fintech brands that are doing amazing things, that have a really diverse range of founders. And they're just prime examples of reasons why we need diversity.
Definitely. And is this full circle? Because that was the very first topic that we discussed today. It's been a pleasure having you in this show, Shamir.
It's been absolutely fantastic being on. I really enjoyed this conversation today.
Me too. Thank you. And everyone, see you next week. Ciao.
Thanks so much for listening. Your time and energy means a lot. If you want to support the show, remember to give it a follow and DM me to get in touch. I promise I do respond.